Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
There was a time not so long ago when physicists thought the world consisted ultimately only of tiny point-like particles. Not anymore. Quantum mechanics and relativity, the foundational theories of modern physics, have together forced us to believe that the world on the smallest scale consists of a menagerie of tiny entities, not only particles, but also strings and membranes. My guest today is one of the pioneers of our understanding of membranes, Michael Duff. My name is Graham Farmelow, and I'm the author of the new book, The Universe Speaks in Numbers, where we encounter many mathematicians and physicists working at the frontiers of their subject. I've known Duff, the leading theoretical physicist, for decades, since I was a graduate student and he was a stellar young theoretician, obviously destined to do great things. He was an expert in supersymmetry, a type of mathematical symmetry discovered by several physicists in the 1970s. I still remember the excitement in the physics community as the potential of this symmetry started to become clear. The symmetry had a great mathematical beauty that much simplified many of the calculations done using the equations of fundamental physics. The symmetry also implied the existence of a slew of hitherto undetected particles, which should in principle show up and give experimenters many new opportunities to study nature at the finest level. Alas, none of these predicted particles has been detected, though their existence cannot be ruled out yet. Duff was an expert in applying supersymmetry to the theory of gravity, the field known as supergravity. Today, he's based at Imperial College London, where, until a few years ago, he held a professorship named after his supervisor, the great Pakistani theoretician Abdus Salam, one of the founders of the standard model of subatomic particles. Earlier this year, I had an agreeable lunch with Mike Duff and then returned to his office in Imperial College to talk. I began by asking him how long it took for supergravity to appeal to him as a promising line of research.
I was immediately taken with it.
Yeah.
But I should just say that Salam got interested in gravity, having spent his previous career on strong weak and electromagnetic forces, round about the time I became his student. And I was aware, as he was, that quantum gravity was a departure from the close relation between theory and experiment that particle physicists had enjoyed up until that time. Mm-hmm. Because gravity is 40 orders of magnitude weaker than the other forces. So we knew that testing it experimentally was going to be difficult. We knew we were in for the long haul, but we thought it was worthwhile because unifying gravity with the other forces, in our opinion, was the biggest unsolved problem in science.
So, in a sense, it was worth making that departure from closely constrained experiment, closely constrained by experiments, to go into the unknown, so to speak, which is what you were doing there.
That's what we were doing.
Yeah.
And strangely enough, it's been like that ever since. Quantum gravity will always be difficult to test experimentally. But strangely enough, many journalists think this is a new phenomenon. They point to string theory, M theory, supersymmetry, as though this difficulty were something recent. Mm-hmm. Whereas, in fact, it dates back to the very beginnings of the subject.
To find a quantum theory of gravity was plainly a huge challenge. What were the most encouraging strands of research when you started out in the subject?
When you tried to compute physical processes, unphysical infinities came up. And that was the major obstacle in merging gravity and quantum mechanics.
So these infinities make calculations pretty well meaningless.
They made nonsense.
Yeah, okay.
So when you apply the usual rules of quantum mechanics to Einstein's general relativity, everything goes haywire. That was problem number one. A second problem was Hawking's black hole evaporation.
Relatively new at that time,
relatively new at that time, but one question was, what was the microscopic origin of Hawking's black hole entropy?
Which
entropy
he hadn't explained.
The disorder of the system. He had a macroscopic explanation, but the fundamental underlying microscopic explanation was a mystery. And along with that was the problem that Hawking himself pointed out, the information paradox, that black holes seem to conflict with the rules of quantum mechanics. So those were the three outstanding problems. And what's not generally appreciated, I think, is that supersymmetry has provided answers to all three of them. Supersymmetry in the shape of string theory has given an answer to the ultraviolet divergence problem. Supersymmetry in the shape of M theory has given an answer to the microscopic entropy problem.
Just worth pausing there to say M theory was a later development of string theory, which we'll come to maybe a bit later. But
yes, M stands for magic, mystery, or membrane. And thirdly, the information paradox, according to Hawking, has been solved by supersymmetry in the shape of the so-called ADS-CFT correspondence. So in my book, supersymmetry has more than fulfilled its ambition. What it hasn't done in recent experiments at the Large Hadron Collider confirm this, is to explain the world of particle physics.
Right.
But that wasn't the reason that many of us went into it in the first place.
Yeah.
So for us, at least, supersymmetry is still alive and kicking.
Many physicists talk about supersymmetry as if it were a proven symmetry of nature. But none of the hitherto unobserved particles predicted by the theory, the so-called supersymmetric particles, have shown up. Is that not deeply disappointing?
Oh, don't get me wrong. I would have been delighted had they discovered supersymmetric particles at the Large Hadron Collider. But they were not a prediction of string theory or M theory. In fact, string theory and M theory are silent about what energies you'd have to reach before you see the supersymmetric particles, which is a shortcoming.
It is, yeah.
But it's not a fatal. Yeah. Not seeing them is not the death of supersymmetry.
Right. And we ought to mention that mathematicians love supersymmetry. Now, that doesn't necessarily commend it to physics directly, but mathematicians call it a boon to them, several of them have said.
Yes.
Which is suggestive, but if not in any way conclusive.
Supersymmetry and string theory have provided lots of impetus to the mathematicians.
Yeah.
Now, from one point of view, that's good. Of course, our experimental colleagues are not impressed by that.
No. Well, they're entitled to be sceptical after all, but...
I asked Duff about how the concept of membranes came to the fore in physics, and why did their existence take so long to be accepted?
Well, strings, first of all, differed from the traditional view that the fundamental building blocks of the nature were point-like elementary particles.
Right.
Strings are one-dimensional objects, like violin strings, that can vibrate. And the different notes, if you like, represent the different subatomic particles. Yep. And it was strings that solved the problem of the infinities. Whereas point particles give you these unphysical answers, the strings were perfectly sensible. But having abandoned point particles in favour of one-dimensional objects, the natural question is, well, why stop there? Why not two-dimensional bubbles or sheets? Membranes or high-dimensional objects that got called inevitably p-brain. A p-dimensional brain was a three-dimensional membrane was called p-brain. Now, this was not a new idea. In fact, the first person to take membranes seriously as a description of particles was Paul Dirac, the great British theoretical physicist, back in the early 1960s. And in fact, the equations that Dirac wrote down are the ones we use today to describe these brains.
What was he doing looking at brains then?
He was asking himself, why does the electron have a cousin which is much heavier?
This is the muon.
And the muon is very much like an electron but heavier. Why should nature choose these two?
Mm-hmm.
And he tried to describe them both as excitations of a single vibrating membrane.
Okay.
Now, that's not our motivation today.
No.
But the equations turn out to be the right ones for our purposes.
And his membranes would be consistent with quantum mechanics and special relativity.
That's right.
That's what he would have been looking for. So there's a sort of deep similarity in some ways with what you're doing here, because you're looking at the same sort of theory, aren't you, in some sense?
Yes, well, one puzzle of string theory, notwithstanding the great successes it had in the mid-1980s, which is now called the superstring revolution, there were not one mathematically consistent string theory. There were five. Now, if you're looking for a unique theory of everything, five theories of everything seems like an embarrassment of riches.
Slightly embarrassing.
And the other puzzle was supersymmetry, a strange, unexpected spin-off of supersymmetry, was that it placed an upper limit on the dimension of space-time. We're familiar with the idea of four space-time dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
Forward, backward, up, down, left, right, plus time makes four. But in the early 1920s, Kaluza and Klein envisaged a world where there were extra space-time dimensions. And this idea was revived when supersymmetry came along, because it turned out that supersymmetry places an upper limit of 11 on the number of space-time dimensions you can have. The puzzle was, these mathematically consistent string theories live not in 11 dimensions, but 10. And many of us who were working on 11-dimensional supergravity thought something's not quite right here. Why does nature stop at 10 if supersymmetry allows 11? And so a small splinter group was looking at 11 dimensions and where that would take us. And it was discovered that although there are no superstrings in 11 dimensions, there are supermembranes. And for me, that was the turning point. It convinced me that 11 dimensions was indeed the fundamental dimension, and membranes were the fundamental objects.
So why did you believe in those membranes then? What was it that was so decisive for you?
Because we showed, along with my colleagues, Stell, Pope and Sezgin, that when you wrap an 11-dimensional membrane around a circle, it looks like a 10-dimensional string. So the 10-dimensional strings that had caused all the excitement were just a limiting case of the 11-dimensional membrane. So that convinced me that membranes were every bit as fundamental as strings.
Right. So you really believe these things actually exist, so to speak? You really believe they're part of nature's fabric?
Well, when I say, I use the word believe, we have models to describe nature, and we adopt them as working hypotheses until something better comes along.
Right, okay.
So in that sense, we believe in them, yeah.
It seems that experts on the string framework were especially slow to be convinced of the need for membranes.
The biggest critics were the string theorists.
Right.
In fact, I used to compare them to the Flatlanders that inhabited Edwin Abbott's satire, which you may remember.
Mm.
The hero was Mr. Square, who lived in two dimensions, and he stubbornly refused to believe in the third dimension. Well, the string theorists were much the same.
Right.
They were stuck in 10 dimensions and didn't want to know about membranes and 11 dimensions.
They really didn't want to know.
No, in fact, one string theorist used to say, I put my hands over my ears every time I hear the word membrane.
Really? That really is not wanting to know.
Yes.
Right. Okay. So just describe how they did eventually go into the mainstream of string theory.
Eventually, yes. I mean, we were working on this in the late 80s and early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't clear whether we were on the same page as the string theorists.
Right.
They were doing their thing, we were doing ours. And then a miracle happened in 1995 when Edward Witten, who was the guru of 10-dimensional string theory, made this astonishing announcement at the University of Southern California that what we used to think of as the five competing string theories and the 11-dimensional supergravity were not six competing ideas. Yeah. They were different corners of a deeper, more profound theory that he called M theory. So after that, although not straight away, even Witten took some persuading, but after that, membranes were then absorbed into the currency of string theory.
Progress with M-theory, the generalized version of the string framework, has been relatively slow of late, compared with the glory days of the mid-80s and mid-90s. Is Duff still optimistic that theoreticians are on the right lines?
I'm optimistic, but what I wouldn't like to do is put a timescale on when the final answer is going to present itself. Because if you look at some of the most recent discoveries that have affected our field, like the Higgs boson, that was predicted 50 years before its experimental discovery. The accelerating universe, which many people believe is due to the cosmological constant, was predicted 100 years ago. Gravitational waves, similarly, 100 years. So there's what people tend to forget is there's frequently a time lag between the germ of the theoretical idea and the stage where it reaches maturity to be able to make a falsifiable prediction, and then even longer sometimes before the experiment is actually performed. So what's required, in my view, is patience. I grow impatient, if you like, with those who demand instant gratification. We have to take the long view.
But accepting that you need that patience is normally a virtue. One thing I can accept that. But don't you think there's something in the argument that says that that we don't have the kind of experimental grounding that people say you had in the 60s and 70s, and it's a lot more speculative and a danger that physicists will start to lose their moorings in reality and go into a kind of mathematical science fiction, so to speak. Don't you think there's a danger in that?
There is absolutely a danger, but that's a danger we have to face.
Right.
There's two. We're faced with a stark choice. Either we abandon the idea of describing all of nature and the full forces of nature, and just focus on three of them, where everything's hunky-dory. Or we embrace all four, but face the dangers that you've outlined and deal with them as best we can.
Finally, I asked Duff for his view on the future of the great quest to find a unified theory of all the basic interactions of nature.
Well, if I come to M-theory, which is the unification of all these strings, brains, supersymmetry. The problem we face is we have a patchwork understanding of M-theory, like a quilt. We understand this corner and that corner. What's lacking is the overarching big picture. And so directly or indirectly, my research hopes to explain just what M-theory really is.
So you're implying that we don't know what it is.
We don't know what it is. Right. And in a certain sense, and this is not a popular statement, but I think it's premature to be asking what are the empirical consequences of the theory, because it's not yet in a mature enough stage where we can sensibly make falsifiable predictions.
So might it be better to describe it as a framework rather than a theory?
If you like those words. In my view, theoretical physics is what theoretical physicists do. So I would call it theory.
But if they go on the wrong track, that's giving them an easy ride because they may not get lost. But okay, I think with you. But are you broadly optimistic still that we're on a good track in theoretical physics?
Well, optimistic is a difficult word. I can't see any alternative. So for the time being, as I say, what we're guided by is the straitjacket, if you like, of consistency with mathematics.
And your relativity and quantum mechanics.
Has to be internally consistent.
Yeah.
And it has to be consistent with what we already know to be true. So you call it speculation, but it's speculation in a straitjacket. Mm-hmm. And I can't predict where it's going to take us.
Mm-hmm. I like that phrase about percolating in a straitjacket, because it's always seemed to me that people perhaps who aren't in the field don't perhaps appreciate how much of a straitjacket it is. I mean, you can't just write up any old thing down.
Right.
You know, it's very, very... I mean, even to do a basic field theory of the particles in an atom, it's incredibly difficult to jam quantum mechanics and relativity together.
I frequently hear critics saying things like, well, you dreamed up these extra dimensions, you dreamed up this supersymmetry, you dreamed up the landscape, as though we woke up one morning and say, what can we do? These are not speculations, they're consequences of the framework that we've set up. Mm-hmm. We're uncovering previously existing knowledge, we're not inventing it.
I think Mike Duffy's right to stress that physicists seeking a unified theory of all the fundamental forces need to be patient. It took the better part of a century to finalise a standard model of the three basic forces responsible for shaping atoms. And it may well take even longer to combine it with Einstein's theory of gravity. Although it's been disappointing that there have recently been so few clues about how to extend the standard model, there's no reason to give up or change tack. The quest for a unified theory of all the interactions is one of the grandest goals in science, and it's important not to expect progress to be uniform across the decades. The conservative approach of pursuing the goal by respecting quantum mechanics and relativity has never been experimentally refuted. Although experiments are giving no surprising clues at the moment, theorists can still make progress. They can do this, as I repeatedly stress in my book, The Universe Speaks in Numbers, by developing the mathematical structures of our best-tested theories. The universe is speaking to us not just through experiments, but through mathematics.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.